Good morning. This is Christina Malisoff and another edition of Tell It Like It Is every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11, followed by Al Jazeera English. Good morning, Kieran.
Good morning, Christina, and good morning, listeners out there in Columbia and Greene counties.
This morning, we have Kathy Manley, Vice President of the New York Civil Liberties Capital Region Chapter, who will be speaking to us about the National Defense Authorization Act. If you don't know what that is, you'll find out this morning, so stay tuned for that. She will also be talking about Project Salaam, S-A-L-A-M. Following Kathy Manley, Melanie Tremblay, who is the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region Chapter, will be giving us an update on the Patriot Act. Do you guys remember the Patriot Act? It's still in enforcement. And
did anybody read it?
So stay tuned for that. The second half hour, we will be talking about Citizens United and their effect on and its effect on the judiciary system. So all that and more. Okay, and do we have Kathy on the phone? Yes, great.
Hi.
Good morning, Kathy. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me, Christina.
Thank you so much for joining us here on WGXC. Kathy Manley is the Vice President of the New York Civil Liberties Capital Region Chapter. And Kathy, I invited you on this morning. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule, but to talk about something that affects us all, which was just passed under the Obama administration, is the National Defense Authorization Act. Can you talk about what that is and the implications?
Sure. Yeah, and it does affect us all, which is something that a lot of people don't realize. It certainly could affect us all in a really bad way. The National Defense Authorization Act is the spending bill for the Defense Department that goes through every year. And since it's hard for congressmen to vote against that, they tend to put some pretty bad provisions in there sometimes. And this year, they put a couple of really, really bad and unconstitutional provisions for detention, which basically says that the military can arrest anyone, including U.S. citizens, anywhere, including here in Albany, and hold them forever with no charges, or maybe give them a military trial, but can hold them forever with no charges if they have any reason to believe that this person is giving support to Al-Qaeda or what they call associated forces. So, you know, it basically is like what happened to many of the people who are in Guantanamo, where they were picked up overseas, sold by somebody for a bounty who said this person is helping Al-Qaeda. And based on that tip, which is just basically most of them are false, those people have been in Guantanamo for the last 7 years, some of them, the ones that haven't been released yet. There's still 171 people there. And we know that the majority of people had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, based on people that have studied these cases. So now this could happen to Americans here. It's really dangerous.
Hi, good morning, Kathy. This is Kieran here.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just to clarify a couple of things, there's been a lot of rumors floating around what it actually provides for, and there's one of our own politicians here in Columbia County stating that, well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It doesn't do any of these things that you folks are worried about. And I'm just wondering, would it be worth reading some of this, and is it accessible? I know it's like a military budget, so it's probably 400 pages long or something, but...
Yeah, those provisions, I have read them. I don't have them in front of me right now. I might be able to pull them up, but basically they say that it allows for, well, actually it's mandatory to have military detention of people who are accused of giving what's called substantial support, which is not defined, to Al-Qaeda or what's called associated forces, which is also not defined. So it's mandatory for non-citizens to be placed in military detention under those circumstances. And as far as citizens go, it's not mandatory, but basically that comes down to whether the president and the Defense Department want to do that to U.S. citizens. And
right.
Obama's saying now that he won't do it, but he also said he would close Guantanamo. You know, he may change his mind, or a future president may decide to do it to U.S. citizens. I mean, Obama has already decided and successfully killed U.S. citizens abroad, like Al-Laki and
right.
Samir Khan,
mm-hmm.
And Al-Laki's 16-year-old son. So I don't know.
Well,
I don't think U.S. citizens are protected.
Right. Okay, so let's just parse this out because this is a pretty deep topic. One is this, I wanted to talk about, first of all, you can hold someone forever without any trial, without just a reason. Who decides who makes that decision about the reason, some kind of reason to decide that a person could possibly be a supporter of Al-Qaeda?
Well, it would be, I guess, between the president and the Defense Department, so the head of the Defense Department.
But that couldn't, that doesn't come out to the light of day. There's no
right.
judiciary, there's no lawyer who can say that this is indeed a reason.
Exactly. Just like with Guantanamo,
so,
I mean, where, you know, you don't, especially if they're never charged, which is allowable under this. Somebody may never be charged. It's basically secret detention based on secret evidence, which is extremely unreliable.
Okay, so the whole idea is of that someone can be disappeared into prison. Would their families be notified? Would there be any habeas corpus?
There would not be habeas corpus because this is saying that this is legal. This is making this detention legal. Mm-hmm. Habeas corpus challenges illegal detention. I mean, maybe the courts would do something about it, but they probably wouldn't, being that it's codified by Congress now. I mean, they might, because this definitely violates the Fifth Amendment due process guarantee, violates the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and right to a trial, a public trial, violates the Fourth Amendment seizure of the person, and violates the First Amendment, we believe, because we believe that protected speech will be implicated as far as why people are going to be detained.
Okay. And then the next portion of this is the idea of substantial support and who is a terrorist, which dovetails into Project Salaam because there's a whole issue of entrapment. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. Project Salaam was established in 2008. To do research and educate people about what we call preemptive prosecutions of Muslims, which is before they had the NDAA, they had to create cases against Muslims that they were suspicious of. And it started, my involvement started with my client Yassin Araf, who is an imam here in Albany, and the government was suspicious of him because he spoke out against the war in Iraq, and he's from Iraq, even though he's a Kurd, and he was persecuted by Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
They did a sting operation against him, and there was a lot of secret evidence that we believe we would have been able to challenge if we could have seen, but we're not able to see. And it was given to all the judges, all the secret evidence, and in the sting operation, yes, he never said anything to show that he even thought anything illegal was going on. He was just witnessing a loan, and the informant said that the loan was supposed to be, he didn't tell Yassin this, but the FBI plan was that the loan was somehow money laundering for a terrorist group, and Yassin never understood that, never said anything to show that he knew that. So basically, we believe he was framed, and the jury convicted him because they were told that the government had good reasons for targeting him, which was based on the secret evidence. And so it was a really unfair case. And then after that, we learned about many other similar cases, mm-hmm. and we started Project Salaam. And we're trying to educate people that there's hundreds of cases where people are charged with things like material support for terrorism, which gets back to this associated forces of Al-Qaeda.
May I stop you just for a second there? Because material support of terrorists, now, am I right? I'm blanking on the name of, I believe it's a doctor who was imprisoned because he was giving support to, I think, a Palestinian relief agency. I mean, what is
defined?
Well,
there's a doctor, Dr. Dafir, and he wasn't even charged with that. They couldn't even come up with those charges for him because they knew that there was no connection to terrorism, but they still went after him for violating the sanctions with Iraq, even though lots of other people have violated those sanctions. But the case, perhaps the worst example of the material support statute case is the Holy Land Foundation case in Texas, where there was a charity called the Holy Land Foundation, mm-hmm. which provided support like medicine and built hospitals and things like that in Gaza. And because the government was arguing that Hamas controlled Gaza, or that part of Gaza, that the money given to these Zakat committees, which Zakat just means charity in Islam, it's actually required that Muslims give Zakat. So these Zakat committees that the money went to that built the hospitals and things like that, and clearly had no connection to anything violent or anything, and they knew that, they conceded that. The argument was that would somehow enhance the prestige of Hamas to have these Zakat committees, to have hospitals there. And so these people who were humanitarians in Texas were convicted of material support for terrorism for providing this money to the Zakat committees. The same groups, the Zakat committees, the same groups that the Red Cross and UN organizations had given money to also, but they weren't prosecuted. And they got, the Holy Land Foundation people got 65-year sentences. Ghassan Al-Ashi got a 65-year sentence, and the others were comparable to that, and their appeal just got denied. It was really devastating.
I can imagine. If people want to, they can go to Project Salaam. I looked at both websites of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Well worth going to the websites and also reading the story of Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hussein on the Project Salaam website.
That's projectsalaam.org.
And that's Salaam spelled S-A-L-A-M.
That's right.
Right. Just to go back one second more, and then we're going to talk about maybe the implications for this is not just Muslim Americans, it's not just Muslims from overseas. You're talking about Americans abroad. I wanted to just talk about what does the New York Civil Liberties Union, what their role is, and so if people don't know what ACLU or NYCLU is, can you talk about that very briefly?
Well, and Melanie can talk about that more, but Melanie Trimble will be on in a little while.
Yeah,
it's basically to protect the Constitution and to educate people about the Constitution, many different aspects of it, a lot focusing on the First Amendment and the other Bill of Rights.
Kathy, I just had another quick question. Could you just remind our listeners a little bit? Christina touched on it a little bit. This isn't just Muslims that we're talking about. The war on terror has been painted for these years to be this war on Muslim extremists, but we're gradually seeing more and more, little by little, all American civil rights and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution being picked apart little by little. You have the situation of Tim DeChristopher, where they tried to make an example out of him by giving him 7 years. The guy who set an SUV dealership on fire, you know, spends a decade, you know, with murderers, actual murderers. I mean, these crimes, you know, the elderly woman I know, someone close to me, a senior citizen, sent money to Iraq for a children's charity, and she looked at the laws and said, technically, you know, they could do whatever they want, and said, oh, that money got in the wrong hands, and therefore you supported insurgents in Iraq.
It has started with the Muslims because they're the most vulnerable, and there's so much animosity and fear and Islamophobia, so that they can kind of get away with it by targeting Muslims.
Right.
But it's like, you know, it has been spreading, and with the Patriot Act, it was supposedly going to be used against terrorists, but most of the warrants obtained under the Patriot Act have been used in other kinds of cases, totally non-terrorist related cases, like drug cases and all sorts of other federal criminal cases. The vast majority of them have been. And it's like Pastor Niemöller said a long time ago, you know, first they came for the communists, and I wasn't communist, so I didn't speak up. It's like, first they're coming for the Muslims, and if we don't speak up, it's going to go on. They're already coming for animal rights activists. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, I believe it is, basically says that if you hurt the economic interests of a corporation in any kind of way that they say is illegal, even without any violence, you can be charged with terrorism under that act.
Okay. So we're segueing into our next question, I guess, if we could address it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on the Occupy movement and how this all relates and whether you see any hope there, and also how maybe these sorts of laws that are being passed could apply to people who are simply trying to exercise their free right to assemble and free speech.
Yeah, I see a lot of hope with the Occupy movement. I'm part of Occupy Albany, part of the legal team, and it gives me a great deal of hope. But I also see that these laws could be used against Occupy, and some people are saying, oh, the NDAA is going to be used against Occupy right away. And I think it probably won't be right away. I think they're going to use it against Muslims first.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an interesting question of why did Congress want to pass this? Because they totally didn't need it. Nobody was asking for it. The intelligence community not only wasn't asking for it, but opposed it. So why are they doing this? And it's, I think, part of a general trend toward repression, and possibly, you know, by seeing the Occupy movement coming up, they said, oh, we better do something in case this gets out of hand. And they may say, well, the Occupy movement is inspired by the Arab Spring, and there's a lot of Islamists associated with the Arab Spring, so therefore Occupy is associated with Islamists, and somehow use that. I don't know what they'll do, but it is a concern.
Kathy, in wrapping up, because Melanie Trimbley will be calling in the next couple of minutes. One is what is the response of NYCLU and which is the New York Civil Liberties Union, to this? Are there any, is there any actions being planned to take to challenge this legally, much in the way that Chris Hedges is challenging this? And what can people do?
Well, people can, I mean, write to their congressman. There is a bill that's been introduced, the Due Process Guarantee Act of 2011. It was introduced at the end of 2011, and it's co-sponsored by 32 House members. And that would basically say that this NDAA doesn't apply to citizens or lawful U.S. residents, so it would help to a certain extent if that could be passed, and just generally educating people about this and opposing the NDAA.
Absolutely. And one quick question. My son was actually at a conference down in Washington, D.C. this past weekend and attended a bunch of Occupy events and Martin Luther King events. There were police everywhere, apparently. And, of course, January 17th was the Occupy March on D.C. And these police were just absolutely everywhere. And what struck me is that they had black tape over their badges.
Oh, that's not a good sign.
And I just was wondering about the legality of that. And I had a quote. Actually, my dad made a quote. He said, that's the difference between a democracy and a police state. So what's
we're
going
seeing,
on with the black tape?
Yeah, the black tape and laws like the NDAA are not what we see in a free country. And I think it might be against police regulations. I think some officers in Oakland recently got actually in trouble for having tape over their badges. But when you see that, yeah, watch out.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, we have Melanie Trimbley on the phone shortly. I can hear her calling in. I want to thank you again, and I want to have you just do a plug for New York Civil Liberties Union. Why is it important for people to know who you are and what you do and
Well, the Constitution doesn't protect itself. I mean, people need to know about the Constitution and about their rights, and they need to stand up for them if they want to have them. If we want to have a free country, we have to do that.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you again. We were talking to Kathy Manley, Vice President of the New York Civil Liberties Capital Region Chapter. I encourage folks to go to the website and educate themselves on various issues, especially the National Defense Authorization Act. Thanks again. We'll have you back on the show if you have time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy, and keep up the really hard work. I know you have a lot of work to do right now, and Go occupy.
All right, thanks.
Take care.
You too. Okay, bye.
Hello.
Okay. Hello, is Melanie there?
Melanie?
No, I think she's going to have to call back, actually. That was
okay, so we'll go
Kathy Manley from the New York Civil Liberties Union calling from, is it Albany?
Okay, we'll go to a quick musical break, and thanks. Stay tuned.
This is Christina Malisoff, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kieran Riley, and we're both here on Tell It Like It Is. And that's every Thursday from 10 to 11. Okay, and we should have Melanie Trimbley on the phone now to join us.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Hi, Melanie. Can you hear us?
Yep, I can.
Okay. Melanie, you're a little bit on the low side, so I'm going to ask you to please... speak as loudly as you can without hurting yourself into the phone.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. So just to let people know, we were just speaking to Kathy Manley, and now we're being joined by Melanie Trimbley, who is the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region Chapter. And I asked Melanie on today to give us an update on the Patriot Act. A lot of folks in the listening audience have heard of the Patriot Act, but may not even know what it is and how it applies to them or how it came about. So, Melanie, thank you for your time, and maybe you can give us a little bit of a background on the Patriot Act, how it came about.
Sure. As most people might remember, I don't know, 45 days after September 11th, Congress decided to pass a very widely sweeping law enforcement bill called the USA Patriot Act. The USA Patriot Act allows the government now to search your home and not tell you about it. They have warrants that can be issued by a FISA court, and then they can come and search your house and tell you at a later time, but virtually they never have to tell you that they're searching in the guise of that you're involved in a terrorist activity. Most people are familiar with Section 215, which is the library provision, mm-hmm. which allows the government to search all records without notifying the person who's being searched, and they can ask that entities such as libraries turn over all of the records that show what people are reading. The way they've defined terrorism in the USA Patriot Act, virtually they can reach out to anybody who's part of an activist group.
Mm-hmm.
They can take away your property without giving you a hearing as long as they can convince a judge on the FISA court that you're involved in a terrorist activity. They can spy on innocent Americans because they now provide for wiretaps that are roving wiretaps, which allow them to tap one phone, and from that phone, if you speak to another person, they can then tap that person's phone, no matter whether that person is involved in terrorist activities or not. Now, the American Civil Liberties Union has challenged many of these provisions. The courts are very slow to move, and they've been very difficult to work with. But we do know, after foiling some information from the federal government, that over 143,000 national security letters were issued asking for private entities to report on their customers. And of the 143,000, we know that 53 reported criminal referrals. 17 of those criminal offenses involved money laundering, 17 involved immigration violations, 19 involved fraud, and not a single one of the 143,000 national security letters led to any charges of terrorism.
Mm.
The same thing with sneak and peek provisions, where they can go into your house, examine what you have there, even take some information out of your house without issuing, without showing you a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Of those cases, there were 3,970 sneak and peek searches. And of any criminal activity that came out of it, 76% were drug offenses, 24% were some other offense, and less than 1% were terrorism, were at all related to terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we continue to look at this huge piece of legislation that Congress continues to renew the provisions that expire, and we continue to work and challenge everything in this USA Patriot Act just about to get them to have a more reasonable view of what will protect us from terrorism and yet still protect the tenets of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
And when was the Patriot Act just recently renewed? Wasn't it in Congress?
Yes, it was in March.
Mm-hmm.
It was the provisions were renewed, and we just crossed the 10th anniversary in October of 2011.
Do you feel? What is your take on public awareness of the Patriot Act, and who is challenging that? Was it challenged heavily in March?
You know, we do lobby very heavily in D.C. to try and get the Congress to pull back on the provisions. Unfortunately, we don't really have the grounds, all the grassroots organizing
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
we need to. When the Patriot Act was first passed, there was a great deal of concern nationwide, and a lot of states and counties and towns passed resolutions calling on various governmental agencies to not abide by the USA Patriot Act. We had several towns around here, Gilderland, the town of Bethlehem, I believe the city of Albany, I think the county of Albany as well, join us in passing resolutions to call on the government to rescind certain sections of the USA Patriot Act that we felt were unconstitutional, including that Section 215. Since then, you know, we worked for about 3 years. Since 2006, there's been very little activity. We thought that we might be able to deal with the Obama administration and work with them internally to get them to roll back some of the provisions, but that has not been the case. So we're continuing to fight the fight, and we hope that people will join in our effort. You can go to our website at aclu.org or at nyclu.org and sign up to help us fight the fight.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think under the Obama administration, I mean, maybe this isn't a fair question, we have the continuance of the Patriot Act, now we have the National Defense Authorization Act, and we still have not acted on the remaining 170 people in Guantanamo who were actually, I think the president promised at one point that he was going to, early on in the administration, that he was going to shut that down.
Yes.
What's your feeling, or what's the pulse, what's going on here?
Well, I have my own personal opinion. I don't think that the ACLU has an official position on how the president is working on terrorism issues and on national security issues. We certainly have we mounted an effort to protest the Guantanamo anniversary and call for its closing as well just a few days ago, maybe a week ago. And, you know, we're going to keep working with his administration to try and get them to understand that this needs to take a priority, a front seat to some of the things that he's been focusing on. There were a lot of promises that the Obama administration made while campaigning, and I'm sure that a lot of people in your listening area promises,
right.
And people are pretty disappointed. I think that's clear, but that's not an official ACLU position. We're just concerned, and we'll continue to work.
In the last couple of minutes that we have remaining, I wanted to ask you if you could just encapsulate for us again what you see is happening on the legal front, under the guise of protecting the nation from terrorism starting in 2001. Can you sum up our loss, the loss of civil liberties and what the implications of that are for, let's say, folks who are protesting, like the Occupy movement?
Well, you know, we have had evidence that a lot of peace organizations and some of the Occupy Albany, Occupy movement, mm-hmm. has been surveyed by police in the area, and so we're very concerned that they're using the provisions of the USA Patriot Act in order to obtain the warrants to spy on Americans who are participating in simply free speech expression. So I wouldn't say we were going to warn people, but we ask people to keep their eyes open, because we certainly would like to hear if any law enforcement agency is pressing to investigate any protest activity that has nothing to do with terrorism.
Was there a couple in Ohio, if memory serves me right, who actually had their home entered and without a warrant and had information removed? I don't know if you're familiar with that.
There is one case, and I don't know if it was Ohio or Illinois, but because
Illinois,
there has been a speaker that's been going around with the Muslim Solidarity Committee and the people who are working on preemptive prosecution. And, these people were involved in providing aid to some organizations that the United States believes has put on a terrorist watch list. These are and the way that they've chosen these groups, I mean, it was the Bush administration that picked out which groups would be on this terror list, seems to not really be an accurate list. Now, this is something that in that particular case, they're going to have to go through the courts and see how the judges decide. And that's one thing that's really of concern to us. We feel that a lot of the decisions that have been made when the Patriot Act has been challenged were done at a time when judges were still very sensitive and worried about the government having enough access to information in order to avert any terrorism. As time goes by and people are more confident that terrorist activity is not taking place, that provisions in the USA Patriot Act are not catching any kind of safety net
right.
with terrorist activity,
right.
that we can roll back the provisions and still be and realize that we can be as safe a nation without infringing upon our civil liberties.
Well, thank you so much, Melanie Trimbley. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, and I would encourage people to go to, as you said, the ACLU.org website and also the New York Civil Liberties Union. It's a great website. You can educate yourself on a number of legal issues. It's I think, very accessible. So thanks again for joining us this morning.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me.
Take care now.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye.
So, we now will be going to a Building Bridges pre-recorded segment. Building Bridges, we'll be talking about corporate power in elections, the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, and that will be for the second half hour. Again, this morning, we were talking to Melanie Trimbley, who is the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region Chapter, and earlier on by Kathleen Manley, Vice President of the New York Civil Liberties Union Chapter. Tune in next week for another Tell It Like It Is, but stay tuned, listen to this. Stay tuned for the rest of the program, and I just want to say a quick goodbye to...
I guess that would be me, Kieran.
Kieran.
Hi. And bye.
Sorry.
All right.
Thanks,
so
guys.
So we're moving on to Building Bridges.
Building Bridges.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
On today's program, We the People, Not We the Corporations, overturning the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. First, a discussion on the court's decision on local judicial elections.
We're going to talk about bowling for dollars. Well, that's one thing, but really, what about judging for dollars? We rarely discuss the ways judges are picked at all levels and the role politics and money play in judicial selection, particularly in the entry-level courts. So judging for dollars with Adam Skaggs, counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law.
Thanks for having me.
Well, absolutely. Adam, really much has been made about how the case of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which was the recent Supreme Court decision that lifted the ban on corporate spending in elections, which will allow special interests to dump money into presidential and congressional races, was decided. But the decision was handed down, in the words of Justice John Paul Stevens, just when concerns about the conduct of judicial elections had reached a fever pitch. So will Citizens United likely create an explosion of special interest spending in this year's judicial races that threatens to further erode the judiciary's independence?
Well, I think that's a real concern. I think you could say that Citizens United has the potential to exacerbate an explosion that is already going on across the country in state judicial elections. What we've seen over the past decade is really already an explosion in spending, both on the end of fundraising by candidates themselves, who raised more than double the amount of money in the past decade than they did the previous one. Just to give you a sense of the figure, from 2000 to 2009, candidates raised almost $207 million to run for high court seats in various states, and that's more than double the $83 million they raised in the previous decade. But not only have the candidates themselves raised money, but special interest groups have been pumping money into these elections in an attempt to gain influence or gain control over who controls the state high courts. So, for instance, of $93 million spent on TV advertising in state high court races over the past decade, special interests were responsible for more than 40% of that spending. These are outside industry groups that want to place sympathetic judges on state high courts. So they've been running a tremendous number of ads. They've kind of become the attack dogs of judicial campaigns, running the most negative personal attack ads. And as you suggest, after the Citizens United decision, which essentially opened the door to corporate independent spending in elections, in federal elections, state restrictions on corporate spending have also been struck down. And we can, I think, expect to see only an increase in the amount of money special interests are pumping into these judicial contests.
So let's look at the selection process in, for example, New York Supreme Court, a court of general jurisdiction, and for that matter, New Jersey. How does this comport with the selection of judges in those two venues?
Well, those figures I just gave were for high court races, the equivalent in any given state of the United States Supreme Court. In New York, the highest court in the state is called the Court of Appeals. In many other states, it's the Supreme Court of those states. So the biggest spending we've seen by these groups is on those high courts. But in New York, some of the worst election abuses that we see are in the what we call the Supreme Court here, which is not the highest court. It's the Court of General Jurisdiction, so basically the basic trial court across the state. And what we've seen there is concerns with money. For example, there have been abuses where judges have awarded law guardianships, for example, to campaign contributors. Brooklyn, there have been a number of judicial selection scandals in Brooklyn where the county bosses who control access to seats on the bench have demanded that candidates hire their political cronies if they want to have a chance to be elevated to the Supreme Court. So we've seen these kind of abuses. Now, in New Jersey, there have been a slightly different sort of questions and concerns raised. New Jersey doesn't have elections. They don't elect their judges. Their judges are appointed by the governor. And historically, that has worked well. Governors have respected judges appointed by previous governors, even of other parties, and have reappointed them when their terms come up. as a matter of course. Lately, however, Governor Christie has decided that this tradition of respecting existing judges is no longer something he wants to be bound by. He refused to reappoint the only African-American judge on the Supreme Court of New Jersey, Justice John Wallace, Jr., and decided when his term came up he wasn't going to appoint him. He was going to appoint instead a lawyer with more sympathetic political affiliation. That has outraged members of the New Jersey Bar. All the members of the Judicial Nominating Commission in New Jersey have resigned in protest. And Christie has really unnecessarily created a real firestorm. So in New Jersey, what we see here is, unfortunately, injection of partisan politics, partisanship into the judicial selection process. And I think that's the other side of the coin of money in our judicial election system, is an injection of really intense political and partisan concerns. And all across the nation, this influence of money and this influence of partisanship is undermining public confidence in the courts as a place where anybody can go to get a fair shake, a case where anybody who shows up in court is going to have a fair, impartial, unbiased judge. Unfortunately, because of the vast amounts of money and because of the influence of partisan politics, people are beginning to have questions about whether that promise of a fair court is really something they can expect.
So the obvious question is whether special interest spending sways judges once they're presiding over cases.
Well, that's right. And, of course, we have yet to find too many judges that come right out and say, hey, you know, I decided that case because the one side gave me more money than the other. We just don't see that. But what we do see is surveys that confirm again and again that the public has real questions about whether political campaigning, whether campaign contributions are influencing the decisions that judges reach. And all too often the answer there is yes. A number of surveys have confirmed that 3 out of 4 Americans believe that judges are influenced, at least in part, by who gives them campaign money. Similar numbers of Americans think that whenever somebody who's given money to a judge's campaign appears in court, that judge should step aside and instead have a wholly impartial judge hear that case. And as alarming as those numbers are, perhaps the most alarming numbers are that judges themselves actually believe this as well. In a survey of more than 2,000 state judges, nearly half, over 40% of judges themselves believed that judicial decision-making was influenced by campaign contributions. Now, of course, the psychology being what it is, I'm sure each one of those judges who said there was an influence thought it was other judges who were influenced and not him or herself. But the fact of the matter is not only the public, but even judges, as well as members of the business community, members of the trial lawyers associations, all these groups have been surveyed both at a national and various state levels, and the numbers have been consistent. The public has real concerns about the influence that money has on what their judges decide in the courtroom.
Well, we have judges who are even running unopposed now who have collected hundreds of thousands of dollars in contributions from litigants, frequently within days of when the judge took action in the contributor's case.
Well, that's exactly right. And one of the worst examples of what you just described was revealed in a Los Angeles Times study of judges running for election in Nevada, where, as you suggest, campaign contributions were dated within days of times that judges made rulings in the cases of the very people writing the checks. So that's been a huge concern in Nevada. And the attention in the press that these abuses have gotten in that state have actually led to a movement to scrap elections entirely and replace them instead with a so-called merit selection system. So voters in November in Nevada will have an opportunity to get rid of their judicial election system and adopt one of these merit systems. These have been advocated by a wide range of policymakers, lawyers, and others across the ideological spectrum. The biggest proponent for replacing elections with merit selection systems is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And after she retired from the United States Supreme Court, she has really made adopting these sort of merit selection programs her signature issue. The way these function, a nonpartisan commission evaluates the candidates for openings on the bench. These commissions are nonpartisan, so no one political party or the other is able to dominate them. They are designed to have a balance between attorney members as well as non-attorney members of the public. And these commissions evaluate potential nominees for judgeships based on experience, based on qualifications, not based on their ability to raise money or their connections to political allies. They then nominate candidates to the governor, who appoints one of these judges to the bench, then they are periodically subject to retention elections. So if, through this process, a judge is put onto the bench who ends up being way outside of the mainstream, the public does have an opportunity in a yes and no vote to vote to keep the judge or not.
Well, I don't want to dampen that too much. I am interested in looking at things such as public financing systems for judicial election. But certainly in the process of New York, when you look at entry-level courts, the selection process, not the election process that does ensue in the housing court and so on, is one that is still rife with special interests making greater determinations on the political composition and character of the judges. And they're not going to be appointed if they are outside of the mainstream or if they are, for example, not supported by the Rent Stabilization Association, which has enormous sway. So it still seems to be a system that is very partisan and represents money interests in any event.
I think that's exactly right. I think New York, in some ways, may have the worst system of any. It's formally an election system in that voters in November in New York will go to the ballot box and have an opportunity to vote for judges, but very few New Yorkers will know much about those candidates. Those candidates will have been pre-selected, pre-screened at political nominating conventions. And these conventions are entirely controlled by the party bosses. So the county political bosses essentially run these conventions. They handpick who they want to be judges. And these candidates they select, they're not choosing these people on the basis of their stellar qualifications or their excellent resumes, if you will. These are being selected on the basis of political favor trading. Folks who have agreed to hire hand-picked cronies of the party bosses will be rewarded with nominations for judgeships. Unfortunately, the voters, faced with very little information about who these candidates are, frequently go in and vote on party lines. So in the city, we see a lot of Democratic judges. In some of the counties upstate, we see a lot of Republican judges just being, again, picked by these party bosses and then, in effect, ratified by the people through a formal vote in November. The Brennan Center, where I work, sued several years ago to get rid of this system, to create a primary system where voters actually have a meaningful input into the process of selecting judges. Ultimately, that lawsuit was unsuccessful because the United States Supreme Court stepped in and said, while this appears to us to be an unfortunate selection system, if the legislature of New York has chosen it, so be it. That's their decision, and it's not for the courts to strike this down. But in that litigation, the district attorney of Brooklyn, Charles Hines, who has put party bosses in jail for selling judgeships, said, and I think very accurately, that this selection system is the last vestige of Tammany Hall in New York. Tammany Hall used to control who ran the legislatures and the executive offices. Fortunately, those sort of party politics, party boss-controlled systems have been diminished for those branches, but unfortunately, it has persisted in the selection of judges. So the judiciary, which should be the least political branch, unfortunately in New York remains to this day the most political branch.
So as we wrap up, what is to be done, Adam? What's a better mechanism than what we have at this juncture?
Well, I think if we're going to retain elections, you suggested earlier public financing. I think that's a great step forward to get judges out of the business of dialing for dollars. I think we can also create better disclosure rules so we know who's funding those campaigns, and we can adopt strict disqualification rules so that judges never hear the cases of those who control their access to their positions. And other than that, I think we need to explore merit selection systems like the type they have in Connecticut and other states across the country, where politics and money-driven fundraising are pulled out of the process, and instead judges are selected based on their experience, their qualifications, and the likelihood that they'll apply the law without favor rather than hoarding and giving favors to their political cronies and or their campaign fundraisers.
And it should be obvious, but why should we care about how our judges are picked?
Well, I think we should care about how our judges are picked because it influences how our courts are perceived and how they do their job. The courts play, obviously, a unique role in our system. They're the only branch where everybody gets a fair shake. Nobody should be favored depending on their political clout or how bad a check they can cut. And unfortunately, when the public loses faith in the judiciary as being a place where everybody gets a fair hearing before an impartial court, courts can no longer do their jobs. They cease being that place where anybody can go to get an impartial trial.
Well, if in the Citizens United era states don't adopt public financing and strong disclosure disqualification rules, the judiciary's credibility will dissolve, and quickly. Adam Skads, attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mimi.
It's a new day. Till now, corporations influence politics with high-paid lobbyists and backroom deals. However, as much as corporate interests gave to politicians, we could never be absolutely sure they would do our bidding. But today, thanks to an enlightened Supreme Court, corporations now have all the rights the Founding Fathers meant for us. It's our democracy. We bought it, we paid for it, and we're going to keep it. That's why Murray Hill Incorporated is taking democracy's next step, running for Congress. The way we see it, corporate America has been the driving force behind Congress for years, but now it's time we got behind the wheel ourselves. Murray Hill Incorporated will bring enlightened self-interest and corporate accounting to government to put business first. It is a vision for the future we can all be proud of. Now that democracy is truly for sale, Murray Hill Incorporated is offering top dollar. Vote Murray Hill Incorporated for Congress for the best democracy money can buy.
I'm Eric Hensel, designated human for Murray Hill Incorporated. We approve this message.
Now the march to overrule the court. Ben Mansky, Executive Director of Liberty Tree, along with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, spoke to a rally at the Wisconsin State Capitol. The demonstration was organized in coordination with MoveToAmend.org and the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign.
On January 21st, five members of the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a heavy blow to American democracy. They ruled that corporations are persons and that the government must protect corporations against we the people. Susan B. Anthony, the great suffragist and abolitionist, she was born today. I found that out this morning. And you know, if she was alive now, she would be here today on her birthday. She'd be celebrating with us. She'd be celebrating by marching with us. She would say, overrule the court. She would tell us today, as she said then, that cautious, careful people always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing never can bring about a reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately, in season or out. She was a founding mother of our country. She was a founding mother of what this country is today. And her part in renewing America included constitutional amendments. And did she and her sisters and her brothers ever succeed? They won the 13th, the 14th, the 15th amendments, abolition, expansion of equal protection, black suffrage. Those were hard won. Those amendments took the destruction of the slave power to accomplish them. And did they rest there? No. They won the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage. A great victory we look back on today. And they spent their entire lives in those struggles. And would anyone here venture to say that those lives were spent in vain? That those gains were not well won? No. On a future day, a multitude will gather here on these steps, and they will look back at what we dare to do here today. And they will thank you. They will thank you. And you're not alone. In addition to the many hundreds of Wisconsinites gathered here today, there are tens of thousands more who have signed the motion to amend the Constitution at MoveToAmend.org. And those people are organizing. They're not organizing in Washington, D.C. alone. They're organizing in Alaska, in Colorado, in Florida, in Texas, all across this country, across the Mississippi and Iowa. There are people who are organizing to build this movement to amend the Constitution. It is stirring.
Let's go to D.C.
Let's do that too. Let's go to D.C. We move, all of us. We move that the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights are the rights of human beings, not corporations. Do I hear agreement?
Yeah!
We move that the unlimited use of money to influence elections is incompatible with a principle of equal protection. Do I hear agreement?
Yeah!
We move that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged. Do I hear agreement?
Yeah!
We make these motions and more to amend the Constitution and to overrule and to overcome the damage the court has done to democracy. Just blocks from here stands a federal courthouse. And I ask you, shall we deliver our motion so that the nation hears it?
I'm so pleased to see so many people out today, and I was thinking about the fact that there were 600 people registered for the Tea Party convention, and that got nationwide news. You know, 600. I think between us and our friends on Facebook, we could outmatch that in a couple days, right?
So, take back the media.
Take back the media. So let me talk to you a little about the Supreme Court. I do think that the fact that there hasn't been an impeachment proceeding even brought, even really talked about, is a huge problem. The fact is that there's been a revolution on the Supreme Court that's been 30 years in the making. This is the product of Reagan's ideological effort to pack the courts. Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Kennedy have all been part of the Federal Society effort to remake our law. They've been doing it for over 20 years, 30 years now in the making. And if we didn't think Bush v. Gore was enough to tell us that there's something seriously wrong with the Supreme Court, this certainly must wake us up to the fact that the Supreme Court has been taken over by not conservatives, but by radicals in black clothing. When I was working for the Senate Judiciary Committee in the first Bush administration in 2001 through 2002 through 2004, I fought to try to protect the courts from this takeover. We fought to filibuster nominees like Miguel Estrada, like William Haynes from the Defense Department, who was trying to get on the Fourth Circuit and maybe make it to the Supreme Court. We fought unsuccessfully against Justice Roberts making it to the D.C. Circuit. These were long battles in the trenches, and then after Bush won election in 2004, the court fell. The court fell. And this is a crucial issue for us in terms of this debate going forward. This court, this five-person majority, these five guys, they're in their 50s and their 60s. They're there for a while. We've got a lot to fight about. There are some great laws in terms of public finance, in terms of keeping foreign corporations out of our elections, in terms of requiring corporate approval of shareholders. Those are all very important measures. But we have to think as well that this court, this majority, is going to be there for many years. And they have demonstrated their determination to strike down sensible legislation intended to protect the sacred nature of our democracy and intended to protect the free speech rights of people. So this is a battle. This is the beginning of a battle. We're going to work on legislation. We're going to work on amendments. And the Center for Media and Democracy strongly supports amending the Constitution. We think this is a crucial effort over the long haul. It's not easy, but it's got to start somewhere. And the Reagan Revolution, the fact of the Federal Society, the seating of these judges for this court started with a handful of people in Washington who were determined to remake our law. And we can counter that effort. It may take time. It will take time. But we've got to come together to say that we're in it for the long haul. We have a vision for our future, and our vision isn't one of corporate democracy.